Arm's Length Reporting for investors who want the whole story. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome in, everybody. Time for Corlin Economics. It's not Corlin Economics, it's Corlin Political. We have a lot of interest in economics, unless, as I know that you do, only because it's very important in the political specter that we like to really talk about. What we're going to be talking about today, in the first segment, we're going to talk about the U.S. economy. The labor numbers came out, and if you believe what you read, which I think you have to, they're looking really, really good. But there is some implications behind that that we're going to bring up. We're going to go on and we're going to talk a little bit about the Ukraine. We're going to talk a little bit about the COVID situation in China. And we're going to wrap up the show. Hopefully by that time we will have a pretty good idea as to what's happening with the speaker situation back in Washington, D.C. As of right now, it's still very up in the air, and there are people who are saying a conclusion will not be come to today. Jim, let's start out talking a little bit about economic indicators in the United States. The Bureau of Labor Statistics came out with some numbers today that said that, number one, unemployment was now down to 3.5%. Well, that certainly is something that Joe Biden and his handlers are going to be able to talk about with a whole lot of pride in the upcoming elections, if that lasts for another 2 years. I don't think it's going to last for another 2 years, and I think people have to be aware of the fact that right now, everything ain't coming up roses. Talk about that, Jim, would you?
Sure. So the BLS statistics that came out showed the economy created 223,000 new jobs in December. In November, it was 256,000. So it's a little bit down from that, but there was an expectation of about 200,000. So it's higher than expectations.
You bet.
For December. You're seeing the markets respond a little bit to that today in the positive realm.
Sure.
So with the unemployment numbers, you definitely have to look a little bit deeper. And what you see is that there's actually still a large number of jobs available, but of the jobs created and of people that are employed, there are a large number of people taking two jobs. And there's fewer people that are entering the job market. Actually, there's a reduction in people taking jobs. There was an interesting, so yesterday, my wife was actually at a meeting that presentation from the Richmond, Virginia Fed, the Richmond Fed.
Yeah.
And they talked about the demographics of who's out of work. And interestingly enough, certainly we know the baby boomers have been stepping out of the job market. They're retiring. You can't really stop that. Some of the other groups that are out, white males are actually stepping out of the job market. And the justification or the reason behind that, a higher percentage with criminal backgrounds, so it's harder for them to get jobs.
Yeah.
Of course,
a very good friend of mine, a guy who I got really close to before he passed away here fairly recently, is a guy named John Walter Williams. Johnny was an economist. He specialized in labor numbers. And one thing that he told me whenever we would get together after shows where we were both speaking is he said, Al, I want to teach you why the labor numbers really don't mean anything. You can put those numbers to prove anything that you want. As Jimmy just said right now, look what's happening to some of the people who are out of the labor pool right now, white males, et cetera, et cetera. I think from what I understand on that one's really kind of a, I'm not sure it's a really important factor, but I would say this, and that is, you really have to look closely at the labor numbers, and only that way can you tell how much of it is brought up by underemployment, how much of it is brought up by the fact that people are so discouraged they aren't even looking for jobs anymore. I know in the part of the Northwest that I live in, up here in basically the Northwest corner in the United States, employment is terrible. You cannot get, restaurants are shutting down. A new restaurant every day is shutting down because they cannot find staff. Nobody wants to work for the money that they're willing to pay, that they can't afford to pay. I understand that's also happening in the major metropolitan areas. So consequently, the numbers today are really misleading. 3.5% unemployment and the job creation numbers, I think, are misleading. I'm not trying to be a soothsayer, for lack of better terms. All I'm saying is consider that when you look at the stock markets. Look what's going on with Tesla, for example. Second day in a row, the Tesla is down significantly. I would think that everything that is going on with Musk's company right now, it would be a really good investment, I would think. How about you, Jim?
No, I agree. Tesla, I think, will be a buy pretty soon. I think market analysts are marking it down, partly because there's a pushback against like the big corporate investors, BlackRock, who's actually on, you know, one of the members of the board of Tesla, that those investors are right now angry at Elon Musk for opening up Twitter. Yeah. And they have a big influence on the market. But I did want to talk back with the numbers and the BLS numbers, right? So you opened the show, you know, you say you got to believe those numbers. But the reality is, back between March and June, BLS gave bogus numbers, according to the Philadelphia Fed,
right,
of over a million job increases, when in fact it was over 10,500 or somewhere around 10,500. Can you trust the statistics? It's hard to judge right now because the administration and the people that are running and providing this data want to paint a picture, and either they're miscalculating very, very badly, or they're actively pursuing efforts to change the narrative in order to protect themselves politically. Well, so there's a big impact, a political impact on these numbers. But here's one other piece, Al, that I think is really important. The expectations were about 3.7% unemployment, so rising unemployment. Remember, the Fed is fighting inflation. They're raising rates because of inflation. And what the expectation is, they're attempting to push people out of the labor market or reduce job growth, actually make higher unemployment to get to about a 4 or 5% unemployment rate. Since that is not happening, these numbers would indicate to the Fed that they want to continue to raise rates. And we just saw the, you know, 50 basis point raise this week. There's an expectation that, in fact, they're probably going to continue for a while, as most analysts predict a recession coming into this next two quarters.
Well, I got to tell you, the word recession is very big right now in domestic economic circles. You can't open a publication right now without some expert predicting that we're going to have a major recession here in 2003. Based on my knowledge of economics, which is probably a little bit better than the average person on the street, I would have to say that a recession is really in the wind. You know, the reason I say that is an economy reaches certain levels because of expectations and feelings of the people in the area that's being measured or being considered, for lack of better terms. It's my impression right now that consumer confidence is pretty low in the United States. Certainly, if you look at it by looking at the political opinions out there, it's got to be very, very low. And the reason I'm saying that is, I mean, look at the approval ratings of the Democrats. Look at the approval ratings of some of the Republican leaders. I mean, they're absolutely
confidence is down,
terrible.
Al. Yeah, confidence is down. The energy policy is continuing to drive prices. They're now heading back up.
Yeah.
We've got huge inflation issues with food. There's a lot of problems out there, and people see it. And you're right.
A lot of problems. One problem, and it's not a problem, it's a reality in the radio business, is you have to adhere to the station that carries you's clock. They have to sell their wares, they have to air commercials, and it's now time for a commercial. Jimmy and I are going to be right back. We're going to talk a little bit about China, what's going on there.
Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome back. Time for segment 6 of the Corlin Economics Report. We're going to try and talk about everything there is to know about China, which is impossible, a Chinese economy. And we're going to give our views on Ukraine. And I know we're not going to get all of this done in one segment, so I'm sure we'll have to really talk about the Ukraine at length, maybe in the segment that follows the top of the hour news. Let's talk about China. China seems to be really infatuated with the idea of, the word really isn't natural selection, but they are trying, according to the headlines, to, for as many people as possible, to get the COVID so there will be a natural immunity. Jimmy, talk about that, would you?
Yeah, so the Chinese government had a very strict 100% lockdown policy up until just a few weeks ago. And that policy was significantly hurting their economy. And of course, that will ultimately impact, as the second largest economy in the world, it'll impact the global economy. But what we saw was a literal uprising, which is very difficult in a totalitarian state that has information control the way that the Chinese government has. So people were managing to step up and step out and say, we're tired of the lockdowns that happened at major manufacturing facilities. The Foxconn struck building that builds iPhones, which tens of thousands of employees.
Right.
You saw pushback there. You saw pushback in Shanghai. You saw pushback in Beijing. You in smaller areas all around the world, all around China. And so what happened is it looks like they lost the ability to control it. So somebody made a determination, let's go ahead and spread and get it throughout the population as quickly as possible. And what that means is that they're going to, you know, be able to hopefully look at the numbers and see how deadly the virus really is, get off these draconian lockdown measures, and ultimately do what, you know, most Western countries have now actually succumbed to, which was a vast majority of people have had contact with the virus. And so they're able to build up either natural immunity or the immunity from these vaccinations. The Chinese government did not use the mRNA technology that has been pushed in the West.
Yeah.
So the question becomes, what did they know, or what are they afraid of, or what were they, are they not willing to pay for that mRNA technology, or are they aware that there's something more nefarious behind this virus that the West has not seen? And I think that's a very important question.
That's a very important question, Jimmy. Very important. Why do you think they don't believe in, or they don't have any confidence in mRNA?
You know, I if you start looking at the numbers, what we're seeing in Western immunology studies that are becoming quite apparent. Wall Street Journal has done reporting this last week on some of these studies. The Germans have studies. The UK has studies. The US has studies now that show the mRNA vaccine, as you take it, it actually doesn't stop transmission. It actually doesn't reduce the level of death. And the more you take these boosters, apparently the higher probability you will get be able to get another variation, another variant of the virus, and it's not going to help you. So maybe they just were not, they're going to let the rest of the world experiment on their human population and just watch it. And that may be what was behind the Chinese policy. And in my view, that was probably the wiser choice. Rather than throwing this out in the population, there's a study, Dark Horse Podcast, which is a guy named Brett Weinstein. If he's famous because he was a professor, he's an evolutionary biology professor at Evergreen University in Washington State. And a few years ago, he was attacked by the students because he's a leftist, but he was attacked because he said, "Hey, we've got to actually have debate and discussion." And he fought against that, started a podcast. He's talking about this. One of our regular listeners posted a link to it. I watched it. Talking about the latest study that shows not only an increase in probability of getting the virus after multiple vaccinations, but the implications to immune systems, which actually drive your immune system to be able to accept other viruses and other problems as well.
You know, Jimmy,
so very dangerous.
Yeah, I have to say one thing, and that is, if you are in a high-risk category, I've read quite a bit about COVID, quite a bit, okay? And I have some friends who are in the medical profession who have colleagues who have also written comments about the COVID and the transmission of COVID. And these guys to a person and their colleagues to a person are all saying that the mRNA is something you really don't want to get involved in if you are in a high-risk category. In other words, somebody in their late 60s, overweight, heart condition, what have you, you really don't want to get involved in that. And so what I would say is for any of you who are in that category, that you really need to do a little bit of research, which is actually quite easy to do. Simply go to Yahoo on your computer and ask the question and then Google the answer. And I think you'll find out that there is a growing number of the scientific community that is agreeing with China that we really want to use something like natural immunity. Natural immunity is basically adheres to those people who are in a safe category, 40s, 50s, 30s, 20s, etc. Safe category being a category where chances are pretty good if you get COVID, it'll be just like a common case of the flu or the common cold. And I know Jimmy has been through that. Jimmy, you've been through it two or three times. I'd like you to talk about your experience with that.
Yeah, the first time it hit me, it hit my son and my wife, my daughter, and it got me. And it was a long time. My chest still feels a little bit tight when I run. There's still a little bit of wheezing.
Yeah.
So, and it took about 6 months before I stopped the cough. And so we really don't know the long-term implications of just the virus without the vaccine. Then later on, I got it. It was lasted a few days. It was not nearly as it actually made me sicker for a couple of days, but it wasn't nearly as long-term problematic as the first time. And of course, if you can trust the PCR tests, I was super hot, very rapid with it. And then of course, most of my family's had it again. We never took the vaccinations. We went to a funeral for my uncle and then my brother, both at the same time in September. We were in a funeral with over 200 people. Everybody that had the vaccine got the virus again. None of my family did. Very surprising to me. So these are all questions with that we got to be looking at and to really do analysis on. The biggest problem has been people silencing information about it.
Definitely have to do that. Top of the hour news time, you guys. We're going to be back as soon as that is over. We're going to be talking about Ukraine and other issues. Stick around. I think you'll enjoy it.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. We're here to, again, continue KER politics. We're going to talk a little bit in this particular segment. I'm going to talk a little bit about China, what's going on in China vis-a-vis COVID and how COVID in China is affecting their market output, et cetera, how that could affect the rest of the world. And then because we have gotten so many well thought out comments about Ukraine, we're going to talk about the Ukraine. Let's start out with China, Jimmy. You wanted to wrap it up by saying something you think we missed in the prior segment.
Yeah. So, we realize, China has gone through this process with the zero COVID policy, which really impacted their economic growth. And now they're moving to this mass, if you will, inoculation through natural immunities, if possible. And of course, they developed their own vaccine. But here's the thing that people ought to be looking for. Because of what's happened with the Wuhan virus, because of what's happening with the Chinese economic output, and because of Western countries disengaging to a certain extent from China while simultaneously looking at potential economic downturn, that's going to be very problematic for the Chinese government. If they don't have the growth rates that they've had in the past, and you know, a bad year for them was a 6% growth rate, if they don't have those growth rates that will sustain their not only their satisfaction of the people, but also avoid some of the real estate market collapses because they've done this massive development projects, they could be facing a very difficult economic situation with a global downturn. And that's what's expected right now. What that means in a typical authoritarian regime, when things begin to collapse internally, and we have seen this step up in the frustration, the protest against the 100% lockdown policies, they may turn an outside eye, and it seems like they're preparing for something with Taiwan. So that's something people need to look at very closely. You know, we saw it back with Argentina in the Falklands War. We've seen it in numerous places around the world. You see it with Russia and Ukraine. You see it a number of places where an authoritarian regime uses a bad guy from an outside. The Biden administration, the Democrats using Russia as a bad guy continually in order to achieve their political ends. And that ends up costing people dramatically. So that's something we got to keep our eye on. And of course,
keep your eye on it. And we can't spend any more time on it right now because we've only got about 6 minutes left for this segment. But we can, if we have to bring up some things that we don't have time to bring up in this segment, we'll carry it over into the next segment. My comments right now are directed primarily at the radio listeners. We have an audience, a regular audience, going back probably 3 or 4 years of about 32,000 people a month. And these people are all very, very active on our blog. They're very intelligent people. They comment on our daily editorials, and they also comment on the weekend radio show. We have opinions that are absolutely fascinating, and I'm going to bring out just a few names to give them credit. One is Irish Tony. These are all handles. Irish Tony, Ebelon, Out of the Box Jerry, CFS, and Larry, of course, and Southfront Fan. These guys have some views on Russia and the Ukraine that are very contradictory to Jim's views and my views at this moment in time. Southfront Fan put up an article yesterday that basically lambasted the United States for the way they have treated the Ukraine since the reformation, I guess I would have to say, of Russia. Jimmy has been asked for sources because Jimmy is not exactly what you would call pro-Russia in this situation. Jimmy, talk a little bit about your sources and your experience when you were an Army intelligence guy.
Right. So I retired as an Russian foreign area officer, Russia, Eastern European, and Central Asian. So that was my focus in my career. I'm a Russian linguist. I've been a Russian linguist since the 80s. And of course, when I look at this problem, I look at it from a perspective. I really love the Russian people. I really love the people that I worked around. But the policies in the government are completely separate from the personality of the people. And what I do, there are numerous sources, and I just want to highlight them for some of the listeners out there. There's some reporting that goes on that's just listserv stuff for people that in my profession, where we get translated articles from like massive number of Russian internal sources. And that's either translated or I translate it. And that's actually looking from the Russian perspective. Then I look at places like the Hindustan Times, which is actually pro-Russian. It's an English newspaper in India, very, you know, obviously 1.3, almost 1.4 billion people, long-time relationship with the former Soviet Union and with Russians. I look at Al Jazeera. I look at BBC. And of course, I look at some of the U.S. mainstream articles. But mostly, I'm looking at detailed information from a wide variety of sources from both sides to make an assessment on what's happening in the circumstance with my military background. and actually with some direct contacts of people that are operating, that are working there, or working the problem. So when I look at this, I'm looking at it from trying to be as objective as possible, but at the same time, I go right back to the situation, the Russians invaded Ukraine. I mean, that's they did it on whatever justification you think is right. I don't believe that it was ever.
Okay,
right to
I don't
that.
Either, quite frankly. But let me jump in here and say something. I am of Russian heritage. I am first generation American. I grew up in a Russian family, which has nothing to do with political issues like we're talking about right now. But I know the Russian people pretty well. Having said that, I want to go on and I want to say that my first opinion about what was going on with, you know, Putin marshaling the forces and invading Ukraine, I thought that was despicable. And I thought at the time that Putin made a huge mistake. And the reason I said that is because it struck me that the Ukrainian people have, and it still strikes me that the Ukrainian people have, a tremendous amount of pride in their economy, now in their country. Now, I want to say that the article that South Front sent me kind of got me to stop and think. He actually sent it to all of our listeners. It kind of got me to stop and think. The gist of that article was that the United States has not supported the Ukraine ever. They have always supported Russia. And the wrong thing to do from a humanitarian standpoint. Accusations have been made that Ukraine is full of the Nazi Party people, etc., etc. I tried to verify that last night and could not. Having said that, I feel sorry for Ukrainian people, because a giant power, i.e. the Russian bear, is stepping all over them. And theoretically, the Russian bear could snuff them out anytime they wanted to. But I really believe in the philosophy of this radio program that I started back in 1995. And that is, on political issues, you have to absolutely look at both sides of every story. And you have to respect what other people are saying. You have to think about what they are saying. And you have to see if you can incorporate that into your thought patterns also. I would sum this thing up by simply saying I feel very sorry for the Ukrainians, in the sense that they are, quite frankly, not in a very good position right now. And I feel sorry for the Russians, in the sense that I think you could have handled this very differently by getting together and talking about the problem and saying, you know, we really, really have to solve this thing out. Let's not have any more loss of life. That's my opinion. Be right back. Hey, welcome back. Here to wrap up KER Politics. You know, in the last segment, we talk about where our information comes from regarding the situation in Ukraine. We talked about some other things, but we did not talk at all about the Russian loss of life that has happened in the Ukraine. Admittedly, the Ukraine has had a tremendous loss of life also, but they are much more effective, I would have to say, at this moment in time. And I think they're way ahead of the Russians in that area. Jimmy, what do you think?
So the defense always has the advantage when it comes to losses. On the offense, you're going to lose more, and you have to plan for that. But the numbers that the Russian forces are losing, and this, you know, this is a combination of UK intelligence, US intelligence, NATO intelligence, as well as Ukrainian reporting. The numbers are crazy. You know, over 3,000 Russian tanks, 2,000 pieces of artillery, over 200 air defense systems, over 280 aircraft, over 270 helicopters, almost 2,000 drones. These are huge numbers, but really the loss of life is staggering. And of course, in the last, just this last week, there was attack on a reception barracks that Ukrainians used the U.S. HIMARS on, and of course it killed, you know, somewhere between 70. The Russian Ministry of Defense is claiming at around 80 or 85, but you know other sources are saying it's much higher.
Yeah,
and it's very difficult to judge any Ukrainian or Russian numbers. That's a reality, because they're going to be shifted to a certain, you know, skewed to a particular objective, right? And a propaganda objective. But at the same time, the Ukrainians have a lot of other observers in their from NATO, and so the accuracy of their numbers and the requirements to meet NATO standards and to be able to backfill the stuff, that it's a little bit more difficult for them to cover up their numbers, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I have to say one thing though. I did watch an interview with Judge Andrew Napolitano and I believe it's Colonel McGregor, is his name. And McGregor, who really has been hands-on in a lot of situations there, has said that the Russians right now are really underestimated by the rest of the world. So,
well, here's the problem with McGregor. Yeah. McGregor, from the beginning of this thing, he said immediately the Russians would have it in 72 hours. McGregor said that the Russians were going to have a massive offensive in the spring, that they were going to lose it. Everything that McGregor has said has been off. I've seen him. I've watched him. He's inaccurate. He's hyped up things. So I don't trust anything he says.
Okay. I'm surprised that somebody of the stature of Napolitano, you know, considers him to be a real source. But anyway, there's a million real sources in the world. Let's talk about not a real source, something that's going on right now in Washington, D.C. They have been fighting back and forth about the Speaker of the House, and Jeffries continues to be the fly in the ointment when it comes to that election. McCarthy just really can't get anywhere. And I would have to say that shows a lack of organization on the part of McCarthy. He should have had it wrapped up before this whole thing even started in terms of support. I would guess that Nancy Pelosi, if she were in Kevin's position, would probably have had the election wrapped up because of her ability to organize. What do you think about that, Jimmy?
Yeah, I agree. She clearly was able to do that the last couple of times that she ran for House Speaker, and she was very prepared for this. Now, Jeffries is really not the problem, because we knew the Democrats would support him.
Yeah.
The problem is the roughly 20 Republicans that have tried to make a stand in a statement saying that McCarthy is not the guy.
Right.
What they're doing is using their power to leverage against McCarthy to negotiate policies and principles and positions on committees,
right,
to ensure that they're respected. And to ensure that McCarthy doesn't fall back on the typical rhino Washington, D.C., Republican surrender caucus policies. And so his challenge, and I agree with you 100% here, Al, he has failed miserably in two ways. One, to get these people on board. That's one failure. The second failure is he has failed to control the voices of his own party,
right,
that support him. People like Dan Crenshaw, from a Republican from Texas, who, you know, former Navy SEAL, who is bashing these Republicans and calling them terrorists openly and attacking people that are saying, hey, what's going on? That is something that should not be happening, attacking their own members. Roughly 20 Republicans that have been voting against McCarthy are using the tools they have in order to try to help and benefit their positions and their constituents what they were elected to do.
Yeah. Well, they're really, really messing things up. There's no question about that, because I believe what the average man on the street thinks, and I've had some personal conversations with some of my neighbors about this, and they are all dead set right now against the Republican Party because they view what's happening in D.C. right now as being a total lack of leadership and a total lack of organization. That's a tough one, Jimmy.
Well, some of those people in our neighborhood back in Washington, it wouldn't matter what the Republicans are doing. They don't like them. The people that are conservative that like the Republicans have been frustrated for a long time with Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy.
Correct.
The failure in the 2020 election, the failure in the 2022 election. Ronna McDaniel right now is polling at about 8% or less than 8% positivity rating, according to Trafalgar polling within Republicans, and she's the RNC chair. They are tired of being taken advantage of. Republicans and conservatives are tired of being taken advantage of. And then the negotiations on basic principles that the Democrats have succeeded in pushing Republicans to compromise on.
Yeah.
That's the frustration level. And that's really what these 20 Republicans are pushing against. They're trying to make a statement. Whether they'll succeed, I don't know. I think it's too early to tell, because even if McCarthy goes over the top, his failure to manage these people does not put him in a good, strong position as a House Majority Leader and the Speaker of the House.
I agree 100%. You know, it's funny, but if you're going to compare Kevin McCarthy to Nancy Pelosi, and you have to say, I mean, I know that a lot of my friends and probably the majority of the audience on this side, on the show, is anti-Nancy Pelosi, but I have to say one thing. She was a tremendously effective organizer. Any comments?
Yeah, I think the party, the Democratic Party, they're the fall in line party. You know, that there's a lot of people within the party that really didn't, on the Democrat side, that don't like Nancy Pelosi, didn't like her leadership, but she had enough power to control them. The AOCs, the Ilhan Omars, you know, there's a number of people that were very anti-Nancy Pelosi, but they were kept in line because of the power she wielded and the political influence she had. McCarthy has failed to do that. So clearly, Pelosi had the advantage there because she understood how the system worked much more effectively than others. The problem is, was it better for the United States? No. Was it better for her progressive politics? Absolutely. You know, the question is getting the American people to wake up to what all is going on behind the scenes. And once again, I'm happy to see this because it really does show the problems that exist behind the scenes in Washington. Yeah. And the people will be able to make, you know, hopefully make decisions in the future that could make a difference. But the unfortunate part about it is the corruption is so deep right now, it's very difficult to overcome.
Well, that's a real problem. There's no question about that. We're almost out of time here, so I'm going to wrap this up by saying it's really unfortunate. The disorganization of Kevin McCarthy is very, very unfortunate, but it is what it is. So if something happens, we'll have an update on that today, although I agree with Jimmy, I don't think it will. Have a good week, you guys.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.